From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Mr. Hastert hurt his victims many decades ago, but today they struck back, and in doing that, they have given us strength. They have given us courage. They have given us hope. We brought the charges we could bring. And through that, Mr. Hastert's legend and legacy are gone. And in its place are a broken, humiliated man. That is as it should be.
That's the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, Zachary Farden. He was talking after the sentencing of Dennis Hastert to 15 months in prison. Hastert convicted of violating banking laws, but the details of the case much more sordid, leading the judge there to call the former U.S. House Speaker a serial child molester. We're going to talk more about that case and the fall of Dennis Hastert and more today, including the governor's call for a bipartisan budget deal by the end of May or even the possibility of a special session. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. He's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio, and Carrie Lester, reporter for the Daily Herald, joins us as well. Carrie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with this Hastert case. I have to say, it might be the most shocking scandal, I think, related to politics, at least with a political figure, that I can remember in Illinois. I mean, others have been found to have committed corruption crimes, but this one a lot different. Carrie, you covered it. You were in the courtroom when that sentence was handed down. It had to be shocking to hear a judge call someone once so powerful a child molester.
That's right, Sean. And not just a child molester, but Judge Thomas Durkin, who happens to be the brother of House Republican leader Jim Durkin, called him a serial child molester. And so he had this line that you could hear the wind sucked out of the courtroom as he uttered it. He said, "There is nothing more shocking than uttering the phrases serial child molester and Speaker of the House in the same sentence."
Now, the judge had really some limitations there on the sentence he could pass on Dennis Hastert. But he didn't, I guess you could say he used his time in the courtroom to at least tell people what he thought of Hastert. Walk us through that process of what Judge Durkin had to say.
He really did. And I think in every way he could, he threw the book at Hastert, who physically appeared to be a very broken man. You know, here was this formerly very gregarious figure that was this larger-than-life wrestling coach, and he lost a lot of weight. He had a stroke. He came in a wheelchair, and at one point, he stood and he addressed the court, and he apologized for all the wrongs that he had committed. But here was this frail fraction of a man that we had seen before. And Durkin launched into this very long explanation, looking at federal sentencing guidelines and explaining what he could and he couldn't do, because Hastert's charges stemmed from making these illegal structured withdrawals from a bank account to pay hush money to a victim of sex abuse from his coaching days. And so the statute of limitation on child abuse had run out. So it was these banking charges that he actually was charged with and pled guilty to. So the guidelines for this crime was 0 to 6 months in prison. Durkin actually handed him a sentence of 15 months in prison plus a $250,000 fine. He said only twice in his career has he gone above the recommendation, but in this case, certainly felt it was warranted.
There was another bombshell, I guess, that was dropped that day when it became clear that one of the people who had alleged abuse by Hastert back in the day turned out to be the brother of another former powerful figure in Illinois politics, Tom Cross, who had been the Illinois GOP leader, Illinois House GOP leader. That came as a surprise for many as well. He apparently decided to come forward, I guess, more recently. Is that what I'd understood?
Right. And there's a particularly ironic twist here. Scott Cross is the younger brother, as you said, of Tom Cross. There are four Cross boys, and they all grew up in Yorkville. Scott happened to wrestle for Denny, and he says he was abused as a senior in a high school locker room when he was alone with Coach Hastert after practice and trying to cut weight before an upcoming wrestling meet. But he was so shocked and so disturbed by what happened that he never spoke of it. Meanwhile, his brother grew up to be sort of a protege of Hastert, this up-and-coming young star within the Kendall County Republican Party. And Hastert, he dedicates a book that he wrote to Cross, among some others. And when Hastert was first indicted, you have Tom Cross being quoted as saying, I'm totally shocked by this. This is a friend of mine. He will always be my friend. Well, Scott Cross told the court on Wednesday that after Hastert was indicted in May, he then told his family. He told his parents, he told his brothers for the first time. But he really wrestled with the decision to come forward. However, Dennis Hastert and his attorneys approached a number of people in the political world to write letters of recommendation to the judge in order to give Hastert a more lenient sentencing. And turns out that Hastert's lawyers approached Tom Cross to write a letter in Hastert's favor. And that seems to be what put Scott Cross, what put the family over the edge here, just looking at the gall of that move.
We'll talk more about maybe what's going to happen to the former U.S. House Speaker now that he has been sentenced. We'll talk about that in a moment. Charlie, I want to go to you because you've covered Denny Hastert through the years, both as a state lawmaker and later as his time in Congress. It's hard to wrap your head around this.
It certainly is. And what you said at the top of the show about this being probably the most shocking, most unexpected event in terms of Illinois political corruption, yeah, that's certainly the case. Typically, Illinois politicians get in trouble because they have their hands in the cookie jar. And that's sort of has been semi-accepted. That's been our way of doing business. We have what's called an individualistic political culture where historically people have gotten into it looking for how they can benefit themselves, their families, their friends, their network. As a matter of fact, Mike Royko once suggested that the city of Chicago's motto, instead of being a city in a garden, should be ubi est mea, which is Latin for where's mine. And so we're sort of jaded about those kinds of financial things. But something like this, the immensity of the crime, taking advantage of young high school kids, and then going on to be in line for succession to the presidency, it just really boggles your mind. And you're right, I did cover Hastert when he was here as a state legislator, and I actually had a pretty high opinion of him as a lawmaker. And I was really impressed because one of the things that he was involved in was rewriting the state's public utility laws in a period of deregulation in the 80s. And I was impressed. Here's a guy who's a high school wrestling coach, and he has taken the time to become kind of an expert on utility regulation. And that, as I say, that impressed me. And there was never any inkling. And yet now you wonder, because as Judge Durkin said, he is a serial child molester. Well, from what I've read and what I've heard, it's not the kind of thing that you can turn on and turn off. And so then the question becomes, what else might there be that we don't know about where Hastert was engaged in these kinds of activities once he was in the political world and outside of the high school wrestling arena?
And Amanda, this has been something that I think, again, as Charlie said, it left people pretty stunned around the Capitol. I remember when the charges first came out and then we started to hear more about what might be behind those charges. That seemed to really throw people for a loop at the Capitol as well, people who have known and worked with him for years.
Very much so. I know I spent that day trying to get reaction from legislators, and many were just stunned. And at that point, you really didn't have a lot of detail. I mean, we still don't know who the individual, the person who brought about all of this, because he had been receiving payments from the former speaker. We don't know yet who that is. A lawsuit is proceeding, because now he is saying that Hastert backed out of his agreement to pay this so-called hush money, really. We have gotten the most detail from Scott Cross, who really that was, I think people have noted, courageous. He said that he had to talk about it because, as Carrie noted, that he had his own brother had been asked for this letter of recommendation, that he wanted to prove this to his children, that you don't stand silent, that it's okay, that you don't need to, be embarrassed by this, but how hard that would be. But still, I think legislators look back at the Hastert actual career, and they're impressed by it. It's this aftermath, or really the precursor, and where we're going to see things going forward is in this subsequent lawsuit. I think there's still a lot of sentiment by some that even the higher sentence passed down by Judge Durkin was not enough, and yet the statute of limitations has long gone by for any of the charges regarding any molesting. And then going forward, what's going to happen with his pension? The teacher's retirement system has moved to take away Speaker Hastert's pension from that point in time. But will Hastert then try to get it back? And you're already hearing calls from politicians now saying they want his General Assembly pension to be stripped.
Well, Kerry, Charlie, let me let you clarify that point first.
Well, I was going to say he could appeal, but there's no way under the sun that he's going to get his teacher's pension back, because the law is very clear that if you're convicted or if you admit to a crime associated with your being a teacher, you lose your pension if you admit to a felony. Now, he wasn't tried on the charges of child molestation, but Judge Durkin pressed him, because Carrie, you were there, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but from the tweets, Hastert said, well, I mistreated some of my students, and Durkin didn't let him off the hook. Durkin said, did you sexually abuse individual A? Did you sexually abuse Mr. Cross? And he forced Hastert to admit it, saying, yes, I did. And that, in his own words, is going to make it impossible for him to get his pension. And the irony is that he can still collect a legislative pension because his wrongdoing, what he was actually charged with, lying to the FBI and this money laundry scheme, occurred after his time in the General Assembly, after his time in Congress, too. And the crimes that he admitted to molesting young men occurred before he was in the legislature or in Congress. So he may get to keep both of those as the way the law is now written.
Carrie, let me ask you, because you've been following this case quite closely. You mentioned that what we thought the former speaker might receive as a punishment, that Judge Durkin really went above and beyond that. Does that open the door for some possible appeal here? Could there be something that could still happen that could change this sentencing?
I think so. I spoke to Terry Sullivan, who is now a legal analyst. He was a prosecutor in the John Wayne Gacy case years ago, and we were passing each other in the halls of the Durkin Federal Building immediately after the sentencing. And I said, were you surprised with this? And he said, you knew where Durkin was going because his language was so harsh, and he really launched into it. But he said that because it is so far above those sentencing guidelines, that he certainly expects an appeal. So I think we'll be seeing one. There was some interesting arguments from Hastert's attorneys where there was one victim in the room. There was Scott Cross, and his family was there, and there was a sister of another victim who spoke. That victim had died of AIDS years before, but the attorneys for Hastert, they had said, you know, we're not making apologies and we're not trying to minimize any of the pain that you have suffered, but they put forth this sort of compartmentalization description of how Hastert had his public life and he had his private transgressions, and they asked the judge to look at the entire arc, to look at all that he had done, both the good and the bad at the same time.
Well, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Carrie, but I thought federal judges have the ability to go beyond the guidelines, and the maximum penalty that he could have imposed would have been 5 years in jail. So in that sense, Hastert got off lightly, even though it was beyond what the prosecutors had said they would ask for in return to get Hastert to plead guilty to this bank fraud charge.
Right. Right, Charlie, I know. I agree with you, and Durkin certainly noted that. He hasn't gone above the guidelines very many times, but he can and certainly did in this case. But he did refer to sex abuse so much in sentencing, which were not technically the charges. I think that's where the argument of a possible appeal rests. He changed the language of the individuals that were named in the filing. They were named individuals A, B, C, and D. He started calling them victims A, B, C, and D. And so Durkin really made the case about the abuse allegations.
And from reading your tweets and others at the sentencing hearing, I got the impression that the judge also said this misconduct with the student wrestlers occurred many years ago, but you compounded the felony by attempting to turn one of the victims into the criminal by telling the FBI that you were being extorted by this individual. And the FBI and the federal government, in Durkin's words, put their full investigative powers into looking at this individual A, and that he had been set up by Hastert. And I got the impression from the tweets that the judge was not at all pleased with that.
Yes, and it's always nice to see that people are paying attention to those as the 24-hour news cycle totally changes the in-the-moment reporting. Durkin made a very specific point that lying to the FBI was a very serious charge, and it wastes a tremendous amount of government resources.
Carrie, before we move on from this issue here, I do want to point out, I mean, it seems like we've been saying how shocked and stunned we are, and yet I keep hearing stories that maybe our antennas are a little more attuned today to such things, but it would have made you question what was going on if you'd have known about it back in the day. The idea that he apparently had a chair where he was watching young boys shower, things like this. There seemed to be some signs there that either nobody took seriously, or maybe they just weren't talked about in a general sense. But looking back on this, there seemed to have been some warning signs.
I think so, but I spent a number of weeks in Yorkville right after Hastert was indicted, and it was the most puzzling case because you knew that there were these rumors that were around this very small town where you have a lot of people who were born there, they were raised there, and they stayed to raise their own families there. But at the same time, very few, at least in the months that followed the indictment, were willing to come forward and talk about what they might have seen or they might have questioned, because Denny Hastert put Yorkville, Illinois, on the map, and I think that there was this an icky internal wrestling that, for lack of a better word, that was going on with a lot of residents out there as they really struggled to come to terms with this larger than life figure's downfall.
It is very similar, I have to say, to the Joe Paterno issue. Although Paterno was certainly not accused of committing any of these acts himself, but you have somebody who's so highly revered in a town, they're a sports hero, and they go beyond sports in a lot of ways, and he, of course, went into politics. And Charlie, I mean, it's very similar to that to me and how people are struggling to take this persona they know so well and match it up with what they're hearing.
Well, yeah, because you have a situation where Denny Hastert was a hometown hero. He was a very successful wrestling coach. They won a state championship under his guidance. And so you look at the image that he projected, and people gave him the benefit of the doubt. maybe someone came home and said, hey, the coach is sitting there watching a shower. Uh-huh. And he says it's so that we don't horse around in the shower. And maybe somebody slip on a bar of soap and get hurt or something. And, you know, parents say, oh, yeah, I guess that makes sense. Without thinking of the sinister aspect of it, because you have such a high regard for this individual, it would never cross your mind that there may be something nefarious about his behavior.
Let's move on, because we do want to talk about other things going on in state government. Not a whole lot this week, as the legislature has been on a break before they really begin the final stretch drive to the end of the legislative session. But Governor Rauner at a stop this week in central Illinois urged a passage of a two-year budget. He says he wants to see that done by the end of May, feels that there can be a bipartisan agreement on that. That's not anything new. He's talked about that before. But then he brought up the idea of a special session, Amanda, and he even indicated he might foot the bill for this, the cost of that himself. He's got the money to do that, I guess, if he thought that that would get them closer. Does this signal some type of change on the governor's part?
It signals a change, at least in his rhetoric. He has said that special sessions aren't any good, they're not worthy, and it is in part because of this cost. I guess if he fits the bill, it would take it off of the state dime, and yet I would be very surprised if that actually happens. It seems as if this is perhaps an occasion where the governor utters something publicly that might be something that looks good and sounds good and is important. Embraced by the public, like, sure, go ahead. I don't want to be paying for these guys to come down to Springfield and do nothing. But I can't imagine what Democrat would take that money and how that would even work in a legal fashion. I mean, is that considered a campaign contribution? Are you going to have that on D2s? It seems to give a lot of pause to how it would work in reality.
And I would add that at first glance, it's, oh, isn't the governor nice? He's going to do that. And second glance, if you think about it, it's a fairly goofy thing to say. And the reason I say that is, as the governor himself has suggested, a special session doesn't really produce anything. It will only work if you already have a deal worked out among the leadership and the governor, and you need the General Assembly to ratify it. And in that case, you don't need a special session, because the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate have it within their power to call lawmakers back into regular session without any additional cost of a special session. And so, as someone else suggested, if the governor has this money that he doesn't know what to do with, maybe he could donate it to some of these human service agencies that are going out of business for lack of state funding.
Well, the governor did sign this week this stopgap money for higher education, and I think he's trying to build off of that maybe and say, hey, look, we can have bipartisan agreement and everybody can come together. A pretty simple vote when you think about it, though. This was money that we talked about on the show last week that was earmarked for schools. It was never appropriated. That's basically what they did. It wasn't like they had to impose a tax or make any major change to have this money go to higher education. So it seems like we're still a long ways away. And the governor did bring up again ideas that he wants to see done in exchange for raising revenue. So, Amanda, I mean, we're really talking again some of the same rhetoric from his side and really from other sides as well that we've been hearing for months.
Exactly. There is definitely a camp that this higher education agreement and deal is a sign that there could be more on the way. And then there is the opposite take, that this instead really just extends an impasse of sorts, and that there is no longer an emergency. They've taken that off the table when it comes to higher education. There's clearly been a willingness, you have to use that term, I think, on the part of the governor and lawmakers to let social services slide as they continue to fight out the politics. And that hasn't changed, and as I noted, perhaps even more so, just continuing on this impasse. So I think hopes for a two-year deal by May that's quite the aspiration by the governor, unless we see something major change. I don't think that this higher education compromise was it.
Carrie Lester, you cover, you're working in the suburbs, you're covering the suburban area and the Chicago area. How is this playing up there? Are people talking about it? Certainly probably not as much as they do in Springfield, but is it getting much attention?
I think that especially when you hear of another hostage victim, so to speak, like Lutheran Social Services or Catholic Charities being affected by this, that's when people's ears perk up. In the suburbs, we are going to have a lot of swing districts in the November election, so you understand that those are real battleground territories. So I've been making a point to watch those districts and those lawmakers and just kind of see that the tune that they're taking. Melinda Bush up in Grays Lake, state senator, is one of them. She's got a fairly vulnerable seat, and she seems to be, picking on the governor for things like not working quickly on this government consolidation task force that she's been working on, and he's made a selling point. So I think people are hesitant to they might be angsty about a deal not being there yet, but I don't know that one is expected anytime soon.
I want to leave a couple of moments here. Amanda, maybe you can give us a quick overview of this. The governor and AFSCME taking this next step when it comes to contract talks. It's basically going before the Illinois Labor Relations Board. Give us a quick overview of what this is about and how this process could play out either way.
Well, really, Sean, I think the key takeaway here is that it could be a long process. These hearings are public. We don't know how long they will go on. And even when a decision is made, it could be, first of all, not either up or down. It could be, for example, that an impasse is found in one section of the contract talks, from my understanding, but not in the other. And then after a decision is made, of course, you could have the losing side do the State Labor Relations Board version, really, of an appeal. So no finite decisions expected really anytime soon, but of course, many an eye on this, because it really is the first time that there has been a case of this magnitude and just the major ramifications of it, particularly if it is found that there is an impasse in these talks and the choices that would leave members of AFSCME and the potential for a strike.
And really, it comes down to AFSCME could be forced to take a governor could give like a final offer and they could be forced to take that, or basically they could go on strike, or maybe there's some middle ground there, but really it comes down to those choices, right?
It does seem to come down to those choices. And
if there's an impasse, I want to make that clear.
If there's an impasse to be found. So there's plenty to go down that road in terms of what that would mean, I think, both practically and politically. But first, it truly is in the hands of the Labor Relations Board right now.
And they are having hearings. I was told those are going to at least continue through the month of May. So this could be something that either at the end of the fiscal year or maybe early in the next fiscal year could play in.
Exactly. And maybe that will weigh in some to the rest of this budget battle as well.
And Charlie, just a couple of seconds left here. I mean, we've never seen anything get to this point before, have we, with a contract?
No, we've never had a situation like this. There have been lengthy negotiations in the past with Democrat and Republican governors, but we've never had this kind of a situation where the executive branch has declared an impasse.
We will continue to follow that over the next several weeks. That will do it for today's show. The members of our broadcast include Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at UIS. Also, our State House Bureau Chief Amanda Vinicky and Carrie Lester of the Daily Herald. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org or search WUIS on iTunes. And the production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.